We will get you to sign a release form before you leave.
Yeah, we do that every time, that's fine.
All right, so are we recording?
We are recording.
Okay, well, Mr. Mutz, I'd like to thank you for sitting with us for a fourth and final recording session. And once again, just for the sake of formality and posterity, I want to ask on the record for your permission to record this interview, to transcribe the interview if we elect to do so, and to make the recording and the transcription available for researchers at the IUPUI Archives and Special Collections.
I certainly are pleased to do that.
Well, thank you very much. Last time we talked, we spent the last portion of the interview talking about your run for the governorship, which was a close race, but in which you were not successful. And there are a couple of questions that I'd like to ask you about that, and then go on and wrap this up. You lost the election for governor, but you had lost other elections, 1964, 1970. You had reversals in business that you talked about. What made this one different?
The thing that made it different, I think, primarily, is that it's such a public sort of an event. Losing the election for state treasurer is public, but not nearly so high profile as this was. And the other thing that made it different was that I'd spent an awful lot of my time, effort, and actually heart and soul, in a sense, in preparing for this, not the election, but for serving. See, some politicians love the election process. They just love the handshaking and the campaigning and the speech giving and so forth. Bill Hudnut's a guy who I would say really likes that stuff. Dick Lugar, on their hand, I see as a person who does it because it's necessary. But his real love is the love of ideas, the idea of getting something done, implementing programs. So it's kind of the difference between the policy wonk and the politician. And I fall more on the policy wonk side. So, for example, and you can argue this was a waste of time now in retrospect, but my campaign staff and my son, primarily, who took time off from his job as a lawyer with Barnes and Thornburg, developed a series of position papers for me. And there were over 30 of them on everything from reforming the court system, the correctional system, to economic development. And frankly, I thought they were pretty good, some of them. And I thought they were things that really spoke about the future of Indiana. And some of those you'll find in the Mitch Daniels agenda. And you found a lot of them in the Steve Goldsmith agenda when he ran for governor. Obviously, he didn't win either. And one of the reasons that Mitch's popularity rating is down right now and Goldsmith didn't win is they scared people with the amount of change they thought was necessary for Indiana. So, you ask what I learned from all this. I mean, those are some of the things I've learned. I guess I'd have to say that the major differences that were, first, it's so public. Secondly, I had spent so much time and effort committing myself to doing this job. And I found, unlike the other elections I lost, I had to go through kind of a grieving process after this was over. And that may sound melodramatic, but it is a form of grief, and it takes a while to get your focus turned around and think of other things you want to do.
Well, the subject of these particular interviews, the underlying subject, is leadership. And I'm wondering, as you look back on that experience, do you think that good leaders learn from failure as well as success? And if so, what did you learn?
Well, I think you learn more from failures than you do from success. Among other things, success tends to feed the ego of a leader, and I'm not always sure that's a healthy thing. In losing, you certainly have to alter your ego to some extent. It has that impact on you. My wife used to say, I insist that John continue to carry out the trash every week at our house, even though he's this high-flying political person, you know. And she says, that way we keep him humble. Well, I think there is a humility of sorts that need to be infused into the lives of leaders. Those who never have it, I sometimes wonder if they don't have the idea, I am so good, I'm so smart, I've got to be right all the time, and you are just not right all the time. And, you know, I see Dick Lugar's election losses as being important molding factors in his life. And the first one was the loss of the presidency of the Indianapolis School Board. Sounds like a small-time deal compared to where he is today, but he took it. It was a hard pill for him to swallow. And, of course, he lost his first race for the U.S. Senate. So, you know, those are molding characteristics, I believe, that make a leader more effective. Now, you say, what else did I learn from this? Well, of course, I learned about xenophobia big time in this election. And its underlying role in the human psyche. I mean, I told you earlier, I read a lot of Jung, and I believe that xenophobia is in the collective unconscious, to use Jung's term. You don't have to agree that there is a collective unconscious, but I think that
you're talking here particularly about the Japanese investment.
Yes, it's the Japanese investment, and we talked about this earlier, I think, in the comments, but its head has cropped up again right now. On the toll road matter, it has cropped up on the Honda plant issue. It has cropped up on the BAA takeover by the same company that is going to be the lessor of the toll road and so forth.
That's at the airport.
At the Indianapolis airport. And those are, it's good to clarify this stuff because somebody else would, out of context, don't know what I'm talking about.
I'm imagining somebody listening.
Exactly. That's fine. But at any rate, I guess what I'm saying is that's the second big issue I learned about this. And I was flattered, actually, to be invited to a couple of universities to actually give a couple of talks about the xenophobic attitude of people that's kind of under the surface. You know, nobody talks a lot about it, but it's there. I guess the third thing I learned about this was that I spent far too much time dealing with the Republican portion of the electorate. That's one of those old saws about politics. The campaign system is changing, and it changed during the time period I was in politics. And so the independent voter became a lot more important in this situation. That's another thing I'd
So you think you played too much to your base?
Yes. And I didn't get all the base in spite of that.
Well, when we started this series of questions, you mentioned Stephen Goldsmith and the current governor, Mitch Daniels, and yourself, and you talked about change.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that it's a mark of effective leadership to pray for be able to persuade people of the need for change?
I think it's important that leaders have an agenda and a vision and that they are able to articulate it. In other words, I think you may have asked me earlier about my view of leadership in general. I think one of the five key ingredients of that is, in fact, the ability to focus on a limited agenda, hold it in front of the publics you're working with, whoever they happen to be, and continue to work with them, I mean, to pound on them, to use the bully pulpit, if you want to call it that, to make those items happen. I mean, I really do think that's a really important question.
What did you intend to do for a living following the election?
Boy, you really got me on that one. The answer was I never thought about the post-election career. I was so focused, I spent so much time and energy on this sort of thing. And as I may have told you earlier, during the time I was in public life, I spent nearly all my personal savings so my kids could go to what I considered to be really fine schools and get a good education. That was the legacy I saw as being important. So I found myself unemployed and with very modest savings remaining at that point. So I hadn't really thought much a lot about that. Now, I had been a businessman most of my life, And so I realized there's some things in that arena I could go back to again. Not a lawyer, not a professional in the normal sense. So I think I may have told you, I had already gone and received a commitment for a bank loan to start a business venture. And then the Lilly Endowment offer came along, and I decided that was too unusual and unique an experience to pass up.
Tom Lake from the Lilly Endowment contacted you. Was that a surprise?
Absolutely. Out of nowhere, this happened. I believe it was February of the year after the campaign, and Tom called me, and of course I knew Tom not really well. I'm not sure many people knew Tom well, but anyway, I had worked with him on the White River State Park and a number of other things where Lilly had made challenge grants and so forth. And he called me up one day. He says, "John, would you like to talk with me about running the endowment?" And I gulped a couple of times and said, "Well, I would be delighted to do that." And he said, "Well, would you come out to my house?" He said, "I don't want you coming to the headquarters of the endowment. Everybody will know you're there, and it'll be an item of discussion and rumor and so forth." So I said, "Sure." And we made an arrangement, and I went out and met him at about 8 o'clock in the morning, which Tom liked to do early in the morning. And we spent a good part of the morning talking about what he wanted to accomplish, his approach to leadership and all that sort of thing. And then he said, "Well, can we make a handshake agreement today?" And I said, "No, I can't do that. I said, I first of all have to do some personal thinking about this. Secondly, I want to talk with my wife. And thirdly, I said, I'd like to know what the compensation package would be. I mean, I've been in business in and out for years, and I decided that the best time to have leverage is then, not after you've already said, yes, I'll do it." So I went home, got together with Tom a second time, again at his home. And this time we talked compensation level and relationships and, you know, the environment and so forth.
Why do you think he asked you? You mentioned that the first time he talked to you about what he wanted to accomplish. He must have had what he wanted to accomplish and you in mind together. How did those two things fit together? Seeking you to lead and what he wanted to accomplish.
Yeah. Well, of course, Tom spoke in his own way for the Lilly family at that moment in time. He felt he took very deeply his responsibility as a representative of the Lilly family. And he said, "You know, our big concern is the state of Indiana, more particularly the city of Indianapolis." And he said, "I need somebody to be out front in this situation and to represent the endowment in a public way." He said, "You run the staff and I'll run the board." That's a quote. And if there ever was an organization in which a board chairman ran the board, this has got to be it. You can argue pro or con, but his philosophy was that the job of the staff was to propose, and seldom ever did the board ever change anything that was proposed. But of course, it was carefully filtered through Tom before it was presented to the board. The Board of Lilly Endowment at that time didn't have a committee system, didn't have a number of the functions that most boards have. So we discussed this just as we're talking here, this arrangement, how he saw the situation to work. You asked me why do he think he wanted me to do this job, and I can't really tell you exactly, except to say that he wanted somebody who he thought had the respect of leadership in the community. Although Lilly Endowment doesn't have to work too hard to get respect. I mean, it's kind of there. And for very good reason. It's an honorable institution. It really is. But I think he also wanted somebody who would shake the place up a little bit. Now, he never said that. But he asked me to think about the future. Now, I decided that it was presumptuous to step into an organization of this nature, and I frankly didn't have an agenda. I had no agenda for Lilly Endowment. I spent my entire first 10 months interviewing and talking to the staff and to a few other outsiders, but primarily the staff. And out of that, I began to create an idea as to what our plan for the next 3 to 5 years should be. And included in that, for example, was the vision of community foundations, state of Indiana, public school reform, a variety of things that were a little different at Lilly. And the other folks who I worked with there, including Mike Carroll, who of course is deceased now, and Craig Dykstra, who came on very shortly after I was there as the head of the religion division of the endowment, both had all kinds of ideas. I mean, they were waiting for an opportunity to put those ideas in effect. Now, what you have here is a situation in which my predecessor, Jim Morris, he and Tom had had some disagreements. I think it's clear.
We talked about that at length.
Yeah, and I would be, I don't know what Jim Morris is even willing to say about them, because Jim is a very careful individual when it comes to confidences and things of that kind, and well, he should be. But anyway, there's no question about that. So this was a new page in the endowment's history, and I had a chance to work on it for the first 5 years.
Well, if we look at some of the elements that constituted the new agenda at Lilly, one of the things was community development foundations.
Well, the community foundation, let me go back and say, okay. One of Tom's great concerns was that here is an endowment funded entirely by one stock. So the vicissitudes, the ups and downs of that stock's performance could have an impact on how much money you had to give away in future time periods. So he didn't like commitments that went way out into the future. On the other hand, he realized the value of long-term commitment to something that matters. It's a difficult kind of paradox. So what we were thinking about there was how we could put together programs that had what I call an accordion aspect to them. You could expand or contract them depending on how much money you had. Well, the community endowment, the community foundation initiative has that capability. And so what we did there, of course, was one of the ways to greatly expand distributions was to give more challenge grants to community foundations. And then later, Lilly has taken up the idea of using the community development network as a way to do things all over Indiana, but they don't have to make the decisions, they don't have to administer all the grants and so forth. So what you do is you give a chunk of money to a community foundation at the local level, and then earmark it for education reform, or earmark it for sustainable community development or something of this kind, and then let them decide how to use it at the local level. And of course the philosophy is, and I think it's a sound philosophy, is that local leaders know better what's needed in the local community than somebody sitting in Indianapolis. So the idea I'm getting at here was that a number of the programs we put in place had this accordion aspect to them, and that was one of them.
Could you talk a little bit about the Lilly Endowment and its religion initiatives during your years as president? I believe Craig Dykstra was involved in that.
Yeah, but the person who really put the thing together originally was Bob Lynn. And Bob Lynn was a national recognized scholar in this field. And Bob is one of those people who taught me one of the early lessons on leadership, and that is there's a time to go and a time to stay. And Bob says, I've done what I can do here, and it's time for me to move on. He could have stayed there for his entire career. He's still alive. He could still be there if he wanted to be. But he said it's time for new ideas, new people, a new generation of leadership, so to speak. And knowing when to quit is not always so easy. We've talked about this before. Yeah. If you have an involuntary retirement, like my loss in 88, you know, that's one thing. But there are times to step down. We've seen recent elections at the Indiana General Assembly involving Larry Borst and Bob Garton. Both wonderful public servants, in my opinion, and yeoman performers in a whole lot of ways, but they probably should have stepped down a little earlier than they did. They didn't step down. They were forced to do
so. Robert Lindon was the initiator of the religion?
He was vice president of religion for the endowment, and he's the one who set up the programs that cut across really several areas. First of all, he activated the program involving the black denominations. Which is a huge program at Lilly, I think an important one, but one that he put in place. Secondly, the study of the deterioration of the vitality of mainline Protestantism in the United States. Bob initiated that inquiry, one of the first scholars in America to cite it and so forth. the third thing that Bob did was he made it possible for Lilly Endowment to get out of just mainline Protestantism. He engineered programs involving Roman Catholicism, Judaism, and even occasionally some inquiries into other of the world's fundamental religious denominations or organizations. And so I consider those to be the initiatives that Bob brought to this table. If he were sitting here, he might describe this in a different way. This is the layman's way of looking at it. Craig brought a great deal of sophistication to the things Bob had already thought about. And for example, one of Craig's early initiatives that I thought was a brilliant thing was the future of theological seminaries in the United States. I think this is one of the great things that Lilly did while I was there. I mean, but the problem was that they were dying on the vine. Financial support primarily being the big problem. And part of it is you don't have an outstanding alumni core in theological work who make a lot of money. There just isn't a lot of new money going to come in from your alumni. And so we came up with the idea, Lilly Endowment, of funding development directors for theological seminaries. And we held seminars on fundraising and a whole variety of things. But we funded, on a three-year basis, development directors for 25 seminaries in the United States. Later on, another 25, as I recall. Well, of course, what happened was we began to develop a cadre of professionals in this field who sought to move from one place to another, and there was a new industry, in a sense, there. Well, of course, our philosophy was if a development director couldn't justify his own salary and that of his staff and overhead and so forth, it would be a surprise. Even the mediocre ones could do that. And the result of this was that a new era evolved. Now, does that mean that theological seminaries are out of the woods in terms of financial situation? No, they're still having trouble. One of the classic seminaries in New York City is still struggling. In fact, had to give its library to Columbia University because it couldn't afford to supervise and take care of this huge volume and this huge collection.
And for the record, what's the name of that seminary?
I'm trying to think of it right this. I'll think of it in a minute.
It's all right.
It just slipped my mind here, yeah. It's like one of those things you...
It's not Union.
Yes, it's Union Theological Seminary. It's Union Theological Seminary, yeah. Union has gone through some very difficult financial times. CTS here in Indianapolis, difficult financial times. CTS is in better financial condition than Union is right now. And I think it's partly due to the aggressive fundraising efforts that have gone on there. So, but as I said, that's an example of some of the things. Craig also got concerned about retirees in the Roman Catholic Church. Again, if you don't pay people during their working career, it's hard to accumulate retirement programs for Catholic priests and nuns. So what do you do about this? Well, Lilly didn't put a big bunch of money into retirement funds, but what it did was do a major national study on the condition of the Roman Catholic Church. The Roman Catholic hierarchy took note of this and gradually has corrected the problem. Now, they've got some other financial difficulties from time to time, but at any rate, what I'm getting at is that those are the sort of kind of things that Craig initiated.
Education was another of the major initiatives while you were president of Lilly Endowment. Hoosier scholarships and middle grade improvement, one program that seemed rather successful and another that seemed to flounder a bit.
Yeah, well, the scholarship program, that's one which also is a question of whether it was successful or not. Our goal with the scholarship program was, in fact, to fill in the gap for middle-income families. You know, it's obviously possible for wealthy families to send their offspring to college. Poor children at that time had fairly substantial support because it was the moment at which the Pell Grant was more substantial as a percent of the total than it is today. Pell Grant is falling behind. But anyway, this middle-income group was the one that the endowments management felt was having difficulty getting it done. And so our scholarship program was meant to fill in the gap in the middle income section. frankly, you know, that was a limited program. It didn't go on forever, but put a lot of money in it. It has not solved the college cost problem, to put it that way. And even if we were to go back and do it again now, it wouldn't solve the college cost problem. But anyway, that was where that was. The second thing was the middle grades improvement program. And we had great hopes for that. And we did it in some of the most difficult middle grade environments you can imagine.
Such as?
Well, IPS being a good example.
That would qualify.
Yeah, okay. And so the situation there was that, what is it, the Hawthorne effect? I think that's the one that people talk about, in which, because of the new attention to a situation, you can accelerate performance and so forth temporarily. And that's what we did there. Temporarily, we really did increase performance in the middle grades, but it didn't last. And the middle grades, I think, are the most difficult of the entire 12 grades of K through 12. It was not a glowing success. Now, since I left the endowment, they have done what they call CAPE grants. The CAPE grants were given to community foundations, and they in turn were used for school reform in local communities. It's too early yet to know how effective those have been, but at best they have been modestly effective. So reforming public schools is a very difficult problem. Now, I'd have to say here for a minute, I don't want to take a lot of time from your agenda here, but the most exciting and far-reaching school reform program that we proposed was one which was designed at changing public will about school reform in Indiana.
That and is the willingness of the public to
the
support
public to
school
support,
reform.
Exactly. Yeah. And this was a combination of local organizing, community by community, actually county by county or school corporation by school corporation, and then a media campaign which supported school reform. And the idea being that in the studies we had done, you need both of these tracks taking place for things to happen. The local organizing effort is where you finally make decisions about what do you want your school corporation to look like, what do you want to do. But the media gives it credibility, surprisingly enough, in our world. If the media is talking about it, it must be important. I don't subscribe to that philosophy, but that was the idea. And we had set aside an enormous amount of money, even to Lilly Endowment, to do this. And we were going to roll it out television market by television market. And our first market was to be the South Bend television. television market. And this is one of those programs that I worked really a lot of time, spent personal time on with our staff. And what happened was the board agreed to the first step, which is a $3.5 million grant, I believe, for the South Bend area over a three-year period of time. And then 2 months later, they rescinded that approval. And, you know, I would have to tell you, that was the most disappointing moment in my life at the Lilly Endowment. And I might still be there. I doubt that, but I might still be there.
Am I reading between the lines a conflict between leaders there? Because if the board didn't do anything without Tom Lake's approval,
he
must have had a different vision of what the endowment should have been doing than you had.
He and his lawyer did.
Mm-hmm. Okay. On the subject of leadership, you and I have talked a lot about leadership
for
about 7 or 8 hours, about individual leadership, group leadership, but it seems to me as I listen to you talk about Lilly Endowment that it may be possible for an institution to exercise leadership. Was Lilly Endowment exercising leadership in some of these programs that we've talked about, education, religion, downtown Indianapolis?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about it. They're the 500-pound gorilla in this community. They are the good housekeeping seal of approval on projects.
Of course, in religion and areas like that, I mean, their reach far exceeded Indianapolis.
Exactly, that's right. But they're the biggest chunk of money in the game. There's nobody that comes even close to Lilly Endowment in terms of grants to religion.
So is money the sole reason why the endowment exercised leadership?
No. It is what I consider to be the other and maybe the biggest aspect of foundation philanthropy, and that is the ability to convene people around an issue. I laughingly, maybe I've said this before in one of these meetings we've had, but whenever I called a meeting at Lilly Endowment, people always came. I mean, they either came or had an awfully good reason why they couldn't be there. And I guess my feeling is the convening power is more powerful than the money. But the money is what gets people to the table. And I guess what I'm saying to you is that, yes, Lilly Endowment employed leadership in a variety of ways. Subtly, behind the scenes, to say the least. In the case of this school reform thing, one of the arguments against it was this is too hot a political issue. Sooner or later, we're going to get our feet in the middle of contested political questions. Well, yeah. I warned the board about that when it was approved the first time. I said, look, if you don't want to get in the thick of the debate about what to do about schools and so forth, then don't do this. Well, they all said we want to do it then. Well, of course, things change. And I guess they were concerned about the what I would describe as the risk of being in the middle of political controversy. From time to time, they've been in controversy. I mean, you could argue about building a dome, the old RCA dome now, about ready to beat the dust, as whether that's a proper use for philanthropic money. You could argue about that, which people did quietly, not very loudly, but did. And there's some other things that Lilly Endowment has done. But, you know, in general, yes, they do exercise a leadership in this community. And taken as a whole, it's been a remarkable asset for this community. Most communities would give everything to have a Lilly Endowment in their midst. In Philadelphia, the Pew Charitable Trust used to be just like Lilly Endowment was. And then their leadership said, no, we're going to become national. We're going to stop being the sustainer of all these institutions in Philadelphia. Fortunately, they did it with some judgment, and they did it over several years, so no institutions just absolutely fell off the financial cliff. But once you become important to a community, then you got an obligation there. And Lilly has clearly set itself up in that set of circumstances as being, well, I don't know what the symphony, the zoo, the children's museum, the Idlejorg, the IRT, and what they do without Lilly Endowment.
I'm going to give back to you a quote that I wrote down when we did a pre-interview with you, but without the recorders on, and it relates to Lilly Endowment and philanthropy, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit because I'm reading my own notes, but you said, in philanthropy, what you learn from what does not work is as significant as what does work. Could you expand on that a little bit, particularly with an eye toward leadership, individual leadership, institutional leadership?
Well, of course, one of the things that you learn, and the quickest one, is about risk-taking in terms of leadership. Effective leaders get out on a limb, and they stake their personality and their reputation to some extent while they're out on that limb. And in my opinion, that risk-taking thing is one of the marks of leadership. And if you fail, that doesn't mean you are done as a leader, because you have all kinds of examples of people who have failed, turned around, and figured out how to do it, and have done other things or the same thing better. You know, so I think that's the first thing, is this business about risk-taking. Now, I am the first to admit that people who get out into the leadership roles and so forth become more risk-averse to some extent the more success they have. Now, there are a few exceptions.
They start to hold the ball at the end of the game.
Yeah, that's right. On the other hand, you've got the Steve Hilberts of the world where it works the other way, and they become so imbued with their leadership ability that they feel, I can't make a mistake. And that's where your ego, I think, gets the best of you in that situation.
How would you assess your own impact as head of the endowment?
Well, I think I did what I could do there, and I had reached a point where I had churned up the waters to some extent, changed a lot of attitudes, changed perspective, and I think I'd done about what I could do. But partly because Tom Lake and I did have a little different vision.
How do you think you changed attitudes and perspectives?
Well, one of them, we changed pretty dramatically the tenor of meetings at the endowment. This was a highly authoritarian kind of culture when I first got there. If you went to a meeting and presented an idea, you better be prepared to defend that idea. Why is this good? Why is this going to work? And so forth. The kind of meeting where you throw an idea out that may be crazy on the surface, but may be the genesis of another idea, that kind of environment wasn't acceptable early on when I was at the endowment. It's particularly important to bright women, in my opinion. They like the idea of an environment where they can throw an idea out, play with it, see what their colleagues think about it, and so forth. And what I found out was, when I went to the endowment, is I kept saying, how can I get creative thoughts out of all these people with all these degrees? I had a whole bunch of PhDs and so forth. And one of the things I did, I went down to Lilly, the company, and asked to meet with the people who work at the bench, have patents in their names and so forth. And I said, how do you generate ideas? Back in those days, Lilly was pretty authoritarian too. Changed a lot, largely, in my opinion, through the leadership of Randy Tobias. He was a breath of fresh air there. Well, anyway, I met with these people on the bench, and they were really bright from all over the world. And I said, you know, how do you get this done? They said, well, first of all, it's a collaborative thing. And that was really important to my way of thinking, because they said, we don't sit at the bench and suddenly, as in the old Ford commercial, we get an idea in our head. It's one that is moved and changed around and challenged and pushed and so forth. And they said, the reason we are here in Indianapolis, there's lots of places we could be, and other people that might like to employ us. We're here because the best people in our field work here, and we want to collaborate with them. Okay, that's a real lesson from my standpoint in terms of idea generation. The second was that almost in spite of the authoritarian environment, in fact, they saw the authoritarian environment as a challenge. How can I get around this? How can I get this done? And I remember a couple of women in this group who were really outspoken. They said, I'm going to in see Mel Perlman. He was then president of Lilly Research Laboratories, and tell him. And she did. I mean, she often did that. Well, here's a PhD with a couple of patents in her name, a very apparent contributor, you know. Like a lot of companies, they had rigorous reporting schemes and programs they're supposed to work on. But to Mel Perlman's credit, he made it possible for them to use 10% of their time on anything they wanted to think about. Dream about this, dream about that. And I have to give Mel a lot of credit for his willingness to do that, because he was under a lot of pressure to produce results. You know, new drugs in the pipeline, all this kind of stuff. So those were important lessons for me. And so I went back to the endowment, and we gradually put some of those things into place. Now, simple things, I told you about the parking place, right, once before that. Those are symbols of that sort of thing.
I'm going to, in a minute, ask you the last few of our standard leadership questions. But before I do that, I'm going to provide an opportunity for the other people that are sitting in the room to ask questions if they want to. So, Jerry Bebko, do you wish to ask anything?
I was going to ask if you were going to take a quick break.
We can take a quick break.
Well, I'm going to have to leave. In fact, I'm going to my annual participation in the Mike Carroll Golf Outing.
Oh, yeah.
Something that's as important an obligation on my calendar.
Do you want to take a break right now?
Else. You want to catch me for a minute?
Yeah.
Hit pause on this.